Welcome to the Implicit Bias podcast series presented by the University of Minnesota Medical School Department of Orthopedic Surgery, Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion Committee in partnership with the Medical School Office of DEI.
Welcome to the podcast. I'm Dr. Hassan, an orthopedic surgeon in the Department of Orthopedic Surgery at the University of Minnesota. So we're kicking off a multi-episode series focused on implicit bias. And through this five-part series, we'll be talking with ODEI staff about implicit bias, how our own biases impact search and selection committees, and drill into key aspects like race and gender. So we planned these episodes for listeners to hear them in any order. And each of them is about 20 minutes. So listen as you drive to work, make dinner, take the dog for a walk, exercise, whatever works for you. So today we open our discussion with Matt and Shanae from ODEI to better understand the breadth of implicit bias and its implication. Welcome, Matt and Shanae. Can I have you guys introduce yourselves?
Yes, thank you. Thank you for having us. So I'll get started with the introductions and then I'll pass it to Matt. So hey everyone, my name is Shania Turner-Smith, and I identify as a cisgendered Black multiracial woman. I'm a Minnesota native. I was born and raised in the Twin Cities area, and more specifically, I grew up in the Rondo community, which is a historically Black community that was split into two with the development of the I-94 highway, which ultimately did displace many Black homeowners and businesses. And I really want to share that because I believe my upbringing definitely in that neighborhood has definitely shaped my worldview and what I bring to my role as a learning and development manager. Housing is definitely a focus area for me. I'm very passionate about it. And so a lot of times folks will hear me talk about how health and housing go hand in hand. And I'm really happy that in my role, I'm able to kind of marry those two passions together. My professional background is in social work. I identify as a macro level social worker and licensed in the state of Minnesota. I received my bachelor's at the University of St. Thomas and my master's in social work at Washington University in St. Louis, Missouri. I've worked the last 10 years in the nonprofit sector, both at the community level, but the last few years I've worked in higher education. And so again, just to give you a little bit more insight of my professional experience at the community level, I've worked at organizations focused, again, on housing and healthcare and mental health evaluation and ultimately community just well-being and community development. And then I definitely wanted to get into higher education as that's another passion and a value of mine. And so the last 5 years or so, I worked in higher education with recruitment and retention as a focus specifically of underrepresented undergraduate students. And now I am here at the University of Minnesota Medical School where I'm really excited to be a part of this growing team within the Office of Diversity, Equity, Inclusion. And my role right now is a learning and development manager. And again, this role gives me the opportunity to marry all of my great professional interests, experiences, and skills. And I'm really seeing all the ways in which we can partner to really move the needle on achieving health equity here within the medical school and within the community. So I've enjoyed these last 5 months with my colleague Matt and I, as we've been cultivating relationships around the medical school with faculty and staff, and we're trying to figure out how we can make sure that diversity, equity, inclusion is a part of all of our conversations every day that we come into work. So with that, I'll pass it on to Matt to introduce himself.
Yeah, thanks, Shanae. Hi, I'm Matt Amundson. Like Shanae, I'm also a native Minnesotan, cisgendered, white male, white gay male. I grew up in the suburbs in Bloomington, and I moved around the state a little bit. I've lived in Alexandria and St. Cloud, and most of my time, however, has been here in the Twin Cities. But I came into the DEI world mostly from my experiences as a teacher. So for about 15 years in my professional life, following college, I worked with learners from middle school and high school through young professionals all the way up through retirement. I worked with teachers as well for many years of my career. helping them build up their resources as teachers and strengthen their skill sets as well. And in a lot of that, it just became so much more invested just in learning about learning, to be totally honest. And I appreciate self-reflection, and I appreciate this metacognition, you know, thinking about your thinking. And then racial inequity issues really stemmed from that as well. And so I got involved in various school districts, different programming that they offered with like racial equity training, and even working with students as well on Gay Straight Alliance committee, working with students from different racial backgrounds and having really blunt, vulnerable conversations with people about their life experiences, because I just appreciate different perspectives. And I think a lot of this maybe just comes from my own upbringing, you know, and I think just from many experiences throughout my life, especially as I've moved to different parts of the state and have had the opportunity to meet so many wonderful people and work with so many wonderful people. But I appreciate the fact that I truly believe that everyone wants to be heard and to be seen. And I want to hold space for everyone in order to do so. And something I love about being here at the Learning Development Manager role here in ODEI is, one, that I get to work with really wonderful people. It's been great working with Shania and really great working with our team. They have been really great support systems just for me and for the development of the work here at the medical school. And folks that we've had the opportunity to meet at the medical school these last few months have just been so welcoming and wonderful and just open to learning. And that's been really great to see. So like Shania, we're just, interested in continuing this work and seeing how DEI practices just can make a positive change in our immediate world here at the U, and hoping that can stem far beyond the reaches that we even have here. So happy to be here.
Thank you both. And I look forward to having a wonderful discussion with you. So I wanted to just ask a few questions, and I'll just start with this one. We hear a lot about implicit bias, but I was wondering if you guys could impart some wisdom on what it actually means and why we should talk about it.
Do you want me to take this one, Shania, to start us off? Yeah, implicit bias is really sort of take a little page from what the work Shanae and I are doing. We believe that looking at implicit bias is kind of the starting point for anything else that we do as learning development managers and the training that we're providing here at the medical school. And the reason we came to that conclusion is because implicit biases are things that we face every day. Every human has implicit biases. We can't shake them unless we bring awareness to that and have an understanding of, not necessarily where they came from, but really just understanding that they exist and what we can do in order to combat them and just be aware of them. So very simply, implicit biases are favorable and unfavorable attitudes or stereotypes that affect our understanding, our actions, and our decisions in an unconscious manner. And they can be activated involuntarily and without our awareness. And what implicit biases really can do is they can kind of take control over what choices we make. And when you think about this whole idea of how it impacts search and selection committees, those implicit biases, whether we want them to or not, no matter maybe just how aware we are of them, they can certainly creep into decision-making practices and maybe who we are hiring and why we are hiring them. So it's extremely important to really understand how implicit bias really impacts our day-to-day work, and especially when it comes to how we interact with our colleagues, with students, and then, of course, when it comes to hiring practices. Shania, anything to add to that?
Yeah, thanks, Matt. That was definitely a great overview. So I won't add too much, but, you know, a lot of what Matt and I talk about in our trainings is how implicit biases are mental shortcuts, and they are based on simple word associations. And so there's a short video that we like to share in all of our training sessions where we kind of go through these word associations. So if I say peanut butter, most folks will say jelly as a word association because those two things are commonly put together. So at face value, these innocent word associations and our biases can be innocent. But, you know, what happens when we start using word associations that can stereotype certain groups? That's when we start to see that error in judgment. So, for instance, if we believe that Americans are only white, right, and everyone else is a subcategory, right? So myself, I would identify as African-American. Well, what does that really mean? Am I not an American? Or, you know, the representation that we see of Black men in the media or in movies being violent, having handguns, all of these things are going to come into our awareness. And without us even knowing it, we may start making stereotypes about folks in our day to day. So one way to think about this as it relates to search and selection and hiring processes is we tend to exclude people from opportunities who are dissimilar to us because we really enjoy being around folks who are like us. It makes us comfortable. It's like a warm, hot cup of coffee. And, you know, just as Matt and I just talked about, we have a really great working relationship and we happen to be the same on our Myers-Briggs assessment, right? So we definitely are drawn to folks who are like us, but we need to slow down our thinking because that is a form of affinity bias. And we know that diversity is our greatest strength. And so the more perspectives we have in the room, the more folks that we have on our teams that are different from us, the better product and that we're going to have in the end. And so just keeping that in mind and just thinking about all the great learning that we can have from those who are different from us as well. And so not letting our stereotypes and our quick judgments impact hiring decisions and the creation of our wonderful teams.
Thank you so much. Those are all excellent points. You know, I think from a personal kind of experience, I've gotten through training and gotten, you know, older over the years, I've had the chance to sit on some committees, you know, for residency where I train and also in fellowship. And I definitely do think that one, there definitely is, you know, implicit bias in selection and it's kind of on different kind of levels. It's sometimes that kind of, that sort of excludes, people from certain backgrounds before they even get a chance to be seen and have a kind of come there in person and have a conversation. And I do feel like one of the positive things of the kind of the social and racial kind of more awareness that we've had over the years is people becoming more aware of that, even in, you know, some institutions or some folks might consider to be conservative. And I think that the first step in improving this is definitely acknowledging that it's there, because I feel like it's definitely very subliminal and, you know, sometimes it's sort of been brushed under the rug, but the first step in the very long process of fixing this is definitely acknowledging it. And it definitely exists in academia for sure, but awesome. So just to kind of follow up on that, you guys mentioned something about hiring and search committees. Can you please tell us more about how this plays out and just kind of give us a better idea of how this kind of, what you guys have seen with that?
Yeah, for sure. I think when it comes to search and selection committees, you know, what the primary kind of focus there is let's come together and figure out who are the people that are going to be joining us, right? That's sort of the next that's sort of like what the process is all about. Like, you know, a common question that I think sometimes is asked is, you know, who's the right fit for us? The problem with figuring out what the right fit would be is that there's already this sort of expectation that a person should be a particular way. And so sometimes some people might be shut out of the conversation because maybe they don't fit a particular mold that one might expect. You know, Shania gave that example of, you know, when you think of American, you think of a white person. Well, a lot of people in America aren't white, right? And so to think that like one person needs to fit a particular criteria in order to fit a particular role, I mean, unless it actually says, you know, what that criteria is, say like on a rubric or like job expectation, you're following that to say what the right fit is. You know, that then we can fall prey to hiring someone. Oh, well, that person, maybe their accent is too thick. And so I don't know that they'd interact really well with our stakeholders. Or this person is from California. They don't know anyone in Minnesota, so they might not be too serious about moving here to this job. You know, we have these expectations that might not necessarily fall in line with what we'd expect. And then therefore we're shutting out people that might be some of the best candidates that we could possibly offer. We're already putting up barriers that might not even be there or might hold someone back from being a really good, from being just a really good selection. So it's really, you know, and Dr. Hassan, you mentioned this as well, and we mentioned it too, just how it's really important just to stay focused on, you know, what's going on internally, what am I thinking, what biases are showing up, and taking time just to slow down and process through that, because that can be really tough. And Shanae mentioned too how she and I have the both same, we both have the same Myers-Briggs, we're both ENFPs, and yet we know that, like, just because we're both ENFPs doesn't mean that we're the best Myers-Briggs. Like, we both know that there are other Myers-Briggs out there, and it's important to get other perspectives and have other people, you know, give us perspectives that we don't offer because we have blind spots, right? Like, especially when we have very similar maybe ways of thinking or processing through things, we have blind spots, and we want to make sure we can fill in some of those gaps and not just expect that we can do everything ourselves. So I hope that helps to kind of answer that question.
Definitely.
Yeah, I will add to it just briefly. You know, thinking about search and selection, biases really can just show up for reasons why we don't want to hire people, to just really underscore what Matt was just saying. And so it is going to be really important for the chair of that committee to take the lead. You know, how are you establishing psychological safety among your committee members? One way to do that is to tell each one of them why they were selected to be on this committee. What perspective are you hoping that they're able to bring to the table as it relates to search and selection? And with that, you're validating, one, there's a reason we want you here, and two, your perspective and opinion is valued in this process. So you're already setting the tone from the beginning. And then you can talk about biases up front. Hey, we all have biases. So as we're making these decisions, it's going to be really important for us to all explain our rationale for why we feel strongly about a candidate or why we're choosing not to move forward with a candidate. So all of those things are going to help you as a committee mitigate bias and hopefully make the best hiring decision for the team.
Got it. Well, thank you. Yeah, I think that's definitely something that we're going to have to do quite a bit of work on. But I do think, you know, as it pertains to residency, medical school application as well, and other admission processes, faculty admission processes within academia, you know, the first thing you usually see is a packet, you know, with someone's picture, and then kind of a personal statement of the sorts. But you don't really get a chance to actually see what the person's about until you invite them for an interview. And you know, I think that is where I think implicit bias can have its worst effect, because when you see the picture, you already have a preconceived notion, and then that person instantly maybe gets a few points deducted from someone else, all things being equal. And I have seen that before, and I think that is one of the worst things we can do to people, obviously, because we're denying potentially excellent contributors to our intellectual kind of discourse that we would have in our community, simply because of, you know, these subconscious kind of thoughts that we have. So, thank you very much. That was very helpful.
That's such a great, sorry, I just want to jump in real quick. Dr. Sonnet, that's such a great example of, you know, I love that you brought that up, because think, like, before we even get to the interview, there are biases already coming into play, right? Yeah. I think, like, when we look at an application, you know, like that's kind of that first step to be like, yes, no, yes, no, yes, no. What biases are maybe playing a role? You know, oh, there's a grammar error on here. They're not fit for the role. I'm sorry. Are you hiring someone who is meant to be a grammarian, or are you hiring someone who's going to be a doctor? You know, right? Like, I think it's easy for us to make those immediate judgment calls. And it's much harder just to, like, take a moment just to stop and pause and recognize what's actually at play here, and what's the purpose, you know, remind ourselves of the purpose. So thank you for sharing that. That just, you jazzed me up with that one. It's such a good example.
That's definitely, I've seen that a few times, and I feel like sometimes you just have to put in the extra effort to just put those thoughts aside and just kind of get through the application and really appraise the person. And, you know, on that subject though, how do you, what thoughts do you guys have in terms of how people can become aware of their implicit biases? Like I think we said multiple times, I think the first step is kind of acknowledging there's a problem and sort of maybe bringing that subliminal thought maybe into your fort, into the kind of the front of your thoughts, so you know that you're doing that.
Yeah, I'll jump in. you know, there's definitely some very tangible things that you can do as a search and selection committee, making sure that you have structured interview questions for each candidate. By you keeping the interviews consistent, that is one way that you can mitigate bias, you know, so that you're not taking one candidate out for social drinks and the other candidates being interviewed in person in a more sterile environment with less libations flowing, right? So structure interview questions, making sure you're accounting for the same space and structure as much as possible. A rubric, making sure that you have some type of rubric that the committee has agreed upon as you're evaluating each candidate. I would say those are some good things to start with, but just know that this isn't an easy fix or a quick fix. It is going to take a lot of trial and error and a lot of self-reflection and a lot of group reflection. And so that is why it's so important for you to pause and make time for that. One way that you may also think about mitigating bias is taking those rubrics and having folks do their own ranking before they come to a committee so that everyone is able to give a rationale for why they selected these candidates to be the top candidates without feeling like they don't have airspace or airtime during the committee to make an argument for moving candidates forward. So that's one way as well that you can mitigate bias. Of course, there's also the Project on Implicit Race, the IET test that you can take. They're always good insights, and it allows you to understand biases that you have towards a number of groups with different social identities. And so they're always adding to that group. I recently took a transgendered implicit bias test and learned about myself a little bit more. And so they're always adding identities to those assessments. And hopefully they'll even talk a little bit more about intersectionality and the compounding of identities and how implicit bias shows up in that way as well.
Awesome. Well, so those are very good points. I think, it's going to take kind of multiple different kind of avenues to help bring this to light. And so kind of a follow-up question to this, I think in, microaggressions are sort of brought on by implicit biases that we have towards different groups of people. And so our sort of external manifestation of our subliminal kind of implicit bias is these microaggressions, which one of my good friends who's a lawyer in town, we've always talked about these, and he's like, these are not there's nothing micro about microaggressions, is what he would always say. And I definitely agree with that. I definitely see that, even as an attending now these days, I'll see that kind of around me. And, I probably had the most experience to that in residency, kind of being, on call and kind of seeing how different, residents may necessarily be treated the next day. And I'll keep it as kind of broad as that. And so I think, that is a very difficult problem that I feel like people have everywhere, not just in healthcare. And so if I can have you guys give a few examples of microaggressions and then elaborate a little bit more on, what your thoughts are on that. And if you really think that they are truly microaggressions or I feel like it's more macro in my eyes, but.
No, for sure. Yeah. I can start this conversation, but yeah, thanks for bringing that up. I think microaggressions are an important thing to really tackle. I think there can be, at least when I say, in my experience, I think microaggressions sometimes aren't even recognized by folks who are maybe saying them. They might think that it's coming from a place of curiosity or relationship building, in some cases, but they really can be harmful, just in building relationships. So just those are the definitions. So microaggressions are brief, commonplace, daily, verbal, behavioral, or environmental indignities, whether intentional or unintentional, that communicate hostile, direct, derogatory, or negative racial slights and insults. So that's the dictionary definition right there, right? Really what that means is it's something that someone might say to another person that maybe, you know, this whole idea of hostility, it maybe shows them as someone who is other, or maybe is not meeting a cultural expectation, or put someone in a little, maybe like a stereotypical box. So I'll share from my example. So I mentioned previously, I'm a gay man, and I can tell you in my experience, I have gotten questions over the years from people, you know, very personal questions that really, like, would any, you know, heterosexual person be asked this question? Likely not. Often questions about, you know, if I'm going to adopt children, or if, or people, you know, weirdly, some people have offered to raise children for me on a potential partner, just out of the blue without even me asking, which is kind of strange. I'll often, you know, I've often gotten questions about sexual experiences, as though that's anyone's business as well. And so some of those things, it's just kind of like that little cut where it's like, why would these questions be deemed appropriate in this particular setting, or just because that is a part of who I am as a person? So that's something that I've experienced as a gay man. So really thinking about this whole idea of microaggressions, it's setting someone else up as an other is kind of the way I like to think about it. It's outside of a particular group or group norm or expectation, or maybe just using some sort of stereotype to make an assumption as to what that person is or what they might believe.
Yeah, those are some really great examples. And you got me thinking, Matt. So, you know, thinking of my own experience, in particular within the healthcare realm, you know, I've gone to doctor's appointments and, you know, they ask a series of questions related to educational level. And, you know, I definitely have had healthcare professionals underestimate my intellect. I'm presuming, due to my social identity, how I present as a Black multiracial woman. And, you know, so some of these things can be very subtle, right? It could be like the exaggeration of your eyes getting bigger when I share with you my educational level, and things of that nature. And so that definitely makes me feel othered. It makes me feel someone of with my identity, shouldn't have as many accolades as I do. And, you know, it really gets into another term we'll throw out here, and maybe we'll get into it a little bit more in another episode, but imposter syndrome, right? So, you know, when we're talking about diversity, equity, inclusion, a big part of that is representation. And right now, as it relates to health equity, we want to see more people in the healthcare professional role that look like, that mirrors the community. And so if you are a person from an underrepresented group and you're already not seeing that much representation of folks who look like you, then you're going to continue to question, am I smart enough to be in that role? I don't see anyone else, you know, and so it's going to kind of keep that narrative going, and we're not going to be able to recruit the talent in which we want to recruit for reasons of that nature. You know, another way that it can be not verbal, another nonverbal, is touching or not respecting someone's personal boundaries. So touching a Black woman's hair, you know, and asking inappropriate questions like, is this your hair? Is it real? Is it not? You know, things of that nature. Again, you're othering the individual. One thing that I know I typically get is I tend to wear my hair curly, and then I'll flat iron it and wear it straight. And a microaggression can be my supervisor coming to me and saying, oh, I really like when you have your hair straightened. You look way more professional, but then doesn't compliment me if I wear my hair curly, right? So it's all these little messages that we're getting, going back to Matt's earlier point about fit. So when we say we want diversity, are we trying to get someone to mold into what we think they should be? Or are we really accepting folks for who they are and allowing them to bring their authentic selves to work? And so that's what we have to ask ourselves as we're thinking about implicit biases in general and about the community that we wish to have, as it relates not only to our colleagues and how we want to be treated at work, but also the care that we're giving to our patients.
Awesome. Thank you so much. These are very awesome examples, and I really appreciate you guys' insight on this. So, you know, kind of following up on this, if someone were to say a microaggression to someone else, how might they respond in a way that doesn't make the situation worse? Sometimes giving a kind of an obvious response to a very subtle kind of, I don't want to say jab, but like, you know, kind of action that someone does on you, it almost makes you seem like the aggressor. And that always is sort of a tough situation. So kind of what tools do you guys kind of suggest or kind of options do you guys have on that?
Yeah, sure. I can start. So honestly, in some cases, you might just say if it's something that honestly just like hurt your feelings or something that was, you know, maybe just made you uncomfortable, just call it out, say, ouch, you know, name it. That might be uncomfortable for a lot of people to say, but also would you rather, you know, I try to think of it like, would I rather just like approach the issue in a respectful way to say like, you know, I don't feel comfortable having this conversation, or would you rather just uncomfortably answer the question that was asked, or, you know, do what the person said, just because you'd rather just feel that humiliation or that otherness over just, you know, like Shania said, like be your authentic self and, you know, not endure that maybe sort of pain that you felt. So say, ouch. I think that's okay. And it's important to challenge someone else's thinking, just, you know, to say like, I'm just not comfortable sharing this. I'm not prepared to answer this question, or, you know, this is, you know, just for me.
Yeah, those are really great suggestions, Matt. And it got me thinking. So when we think of fight, flight, and freeze, I'm definitely the freezer. So when people will say things to me that I can't believe that they said, I just like pause and I can't get my words to come out, and I can't always address things in the moment. And then you layer that with me being from Minnesota and not always wanting to be in direct conflict with folks. And then you get to a situation where you're like, this happened, but I didn't say anything. So another approach would be delay. Talk to, you know, some trusted individuals to get their perspective, process it with other folks. But again, I want to turn the question back and say, how are leaders within a department creating that psychological safety? So when you are meeting as a team, how are you sharing these experiences? How are you soliciting this feedback during one-on-one meetings and making sure that folks are feeling safe at work, they're feeling valued, they're feeling cared for? And it could be as simple as, hey, you know, tell me about the highs and lows of the workday. And, you know, creating that space for someone to share may lead them to talking about microaggressions or other ways that they're not feeling a part of the team and feeling valued. But if people don't have those feedback mechanisms, then they're going to suffer in silence. And so let's think about, again, the community that we're aspiring to have and how we're going to create that community and that sense of belonging for everyone.
Thank you. Yeah, that's definitely a good point. And, you know, I think, you know, from in terms of like kind of having people feel sort of safe enough to call out these microaggressions, I think definitely leadership does play a role. You know, I've seen scenarios where some more senior staff might see something that like kind of the whole room notices might be directed at a trainee or a student or someone else, you know, like, and that person sort of calling it out and saying, hey, you know, that's not cool. You know, like there was an example when I was in Boston. We were during the George Floyd, situation where, the entire world was attention of the world was placed on Minnesota. I remember we were in the OR and, I was a fellow at the time, but there was a staff member that had mentioned kind of talking about George Floyd's, like his criminal history, as if like to kind of suggest that this was, like to kind of almost suggest that like that, you know, I don't know if they meant to say deserved it or something, but you know, I heard that and I was like, you know, what is that supposed to mean? And then before I could even get a word out, kind of the oldest person in the room was the senior anesthesiologist, kind of called it out and said, you know, it's unacceptable. Like, you know, like, it said, you know, like, no human being deserves that. And you know, I was very, very surprised because like I was getting ready to say something, but obviously, from someone that's been there for 30 years, I'm saying that had a much higher kind of effect than me being there for, you know, like 2 years and then being gone. And it made me gain a lot of more respect for, one, the system, because I'd always gotten used to things sort of getting brushed under the rug. But it kind of speaks to, if the leader in the room sort of calls it out, that changes the entire ambiance of everything. And then that other person, you know, apologized and kind of realized the foolishness of what they had said. And the entire room, kind of the whole situation changed. And that showed me that, you know, when I get into that role or whoever else might be there, kind of the person that has the biggest kind of effect on stamping this out is the person that's the most senior or the leader. And it's, I'm sure it's tough for certain people, but some people, you know, kind of just can call it out. And I think kind of sort of wrapping all of this up, I would say that is more of what we need, and having folks like that be more comfortable to do that. And just, I think that's the best way to kind of get this problem, you know, hopefully start the long process towards kind of making everyone feel comfortable in those situations. So to just wrap up and close, thank you, Matt and Shanae, and thank you to our listeners for joining today. And we'll be back next time to talk about implicit bias and race. Just a few last words. Do you guys have any other sort of comments to add before we kind of wrap up the podcast?
I would just say, keep listening, and Matt and I hope to see you at some future trainings. And Dr. Hassan, thank you so much for sharing that last example. I think that definitely illustrates how we can create psychological safety, call things out in real time. And you walked away aspiring to be like that leader, right? And so, you know, that was the best way to wrap up this episode. So thank you for your vulnerability and sharing that.
I totally agree. You know, everyone has a right to say something and to speak up when you feel uncomfortable. You know, and I hope that we all feel empowered to do so, and that we all have that psychological safety to do that. So, and you gave that great example too of just saying, you know, like you were going to ask, you know, what did you mean by that? You know, asking that question just to clarify is, did I hear you right? You know, is really important as well. We all have that right to share those things. So let's keep doing that and to exude that positivity and that growth and learning from that hierarchical standpoint, you know, from leadership standpoint is really important. So that's really great. Thank you so much for your time today too, Dr. Sun. This was a great conversation.
Well, thank you guys. This is awesome. And I look forward to the next few podcasts. You guys have a wonderful day.
You too.
This has been a partnership between the University of Minnesota Medical School, Department of Orthopedic Surgery, Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion Committee, and the Medical School Office of DEI. Thank you for listening.